built living stone by living stone. It includes us. If you're a Christian believer who has come to Jesus, then you are part of that eternal building. And it will continue to grow stone by stone until the day Jesus is revealed to the whole of creation. And maybe more than any other, this passage explains how God's plan for the church will unfold and our part in it. Well, let's start with two opposite things the Bible teaches about God and the world. One is that God is transcendent, which means that he's different from, other than the world, beyond anything in it. And the other, the opposite, is that he's immanent, which means he's close to, he's intimately involved with everything in the world. Everything in the world depends completely upon him. God is both those two very different things, transcendent, beyond the world, and immanent, close and involved in it. C.S. Lewis called him the transcendental interferer. Well, right from the start of the Bible story, we see God engaging with his people. He meets Abraham and is the fire that passes through the two halves of the sacrifices. He appears to Moses and meets him as the burning bush and says, "Come closer, this is my name." And then he comes and dwells in the midst of his people in a tabernacle or tent with the 12 tribes camped around him, three on each side. And whenever he moves, they move. God is always with them. When they get to the promised land, they must build a temple, a place for God to dwell and put his name, his presence. They can come and meet with him there. And when that fails because the people just can't obey him, God does something even more extraordinary. He becomes a human being. And he lives among his people as one of them, God with us. And even when they kill him, he comes back to life. He won't give up on being with his people. But then there's a shock, because when they ask him, "Are you now going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" Jesus says, "No, I'm going back to heaven. You're going to build the kingdom." This small group of very ordinary people who appear to have no qualifications for anything are going to build God's kingdom. The only qualification they do have is that they seem to have understood who he is. When we had a discussion 2 weeks ago about the previous bit of 1 Peter, Stuart Holmes said, "Well, it's all very simple. It's about thy kingdom come. That's what matters." And Stuart, I want to say you're right. It is about thy kingdom come, but the question is, how is the kingdom going to come? And this is the answer through this funny little group of believers being built together one by one as living stones, with Christ as the king in the center. The kingdom is the place where Jesus is recognized as king. And in that building, Jesus will be at the center among his people. And this begins to show us how that happens. So let's look at the passage, start with verse 4. "As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by human beings, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house." We'll stop there. So it starts with you coming to him, the living stone, rejected by people but chosen by God. That's obviously Jesus. We don't come to Jesus by coming to church and becoming a member of church, and that's what qualifies us. We become a member of the true church by coming to Jesus. It's that way around. We must come personally to him one by one, make our own personal decision. No one can do it for us. Many people reject him. They stumble over him. They don't believe in him. But to you who believe, verse 7, this stone is precious. He's the one on whom everything is built, and he's at the center of everything. He is, again, God among his people. Now, Peter here uses two slightly different images for Jesus as the stone at the center of the temple. In verse 6, he quotes Isaiah chapter 28, and he says, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone. And the image there is the foundation stone right at the start of the building. Everything else is joined to and rests upon that stone. It bears the weight. But then in verse 7, he quotes Psalm 118, which we saw Jesus quoting earlier. And that says, the top of the next column, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. And that's the headstone, the one right at the top that all the others are building towards. So two slightly different images. Jesus is at the bottom at the start, and he's at the top at the end of the building, the thing that crowns the building and heads it. And Peter's kind of saying Jesus is both of those things, the start and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. The building is from him and to him. And so this is how God is going to be among his people. And you're not part of that building unless you have come to him. I don't know about your experience, but I find people are often quite willing to talk about God in a fairly vague way. They say, yes, I believe in God. Of course there's a God. But that God is nice and vague and abstract. But when you talk about Jesus, God becomes rather more real and concrete. And he makes demands on us. And we can't just invent our own picture of him. He becomes the transcendental interferer. And so we find when we talk about Jesus, there's often more resistance and more hostility. And that's kind of what Peter is picking up on in verse 8. The stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. And again, that's Isaiah that Peter's quoting. This passage is full of Old Testament quotes. But as we saw in the first reading that Anne read, Jesus says something very similar about himself, how he's a stumbling block to people, using the quote from Psalm 118. And I think it's just worth looking back. It's in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But we'll look at it on page 990, the reading we had. Just go back to page 990. And verse 42, Jesus said to them, have you never read in the scriptures? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. The Lord has done this. It's marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, he's talking to the chief priests and the Jewish leaders, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. That's looking forward to the church. He who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed. And the chief priests and the Pharisees knew he was talking about them. So Jesus is looking forward to the start of the church, the new people of God, and he's saying that I am a stumbling block, a roadblock, something that gets in people's way, that trips them up, that is awkward and uncomfortable. And we know, don't we, that Jesus will challenge us in every part of our lives. And yet, as we come to him and we come to see who he is infinitely precious. A chosen and precious cornerstone, he's described as here. So everything depends on our reaction to Jesus. Is he a stumbling block to us, or is he supremely valuable and precious? As we see that he is precious, he becomes the cornerstone, and we become part of God's eternal building. In the early 1900s, Gertrude Stein was an American in Paris, and she knew many of the artists, but particularly well she knew Picasso and Matisse. And when they ran out of money, they would come round and try and flog her a painting for a few francs. She had a friend called Etta Cohn, who came from Baltimore and had quite a bit of money. And when Picasso's finances became beyond anyone else to solve, Etta Cohn would be made to go round and buy a few Picasso drawings for 100 francs, which was worth about $20. Gertrude Stein's cook, Helene, got so fed up with Matisse coming round for a free dinner that she used to refuse to make him omelette and instead fried eggs. She said, he used the same amount of butter and eggs, but when he didn't get an omelette, he knew that I didn't respect him. And those paintings, bought for a few dollars, used to be propped up everywhere around Gertrude Stein's flat. Of course, now, 100-and-something years later, we know those paintings are priceless. They're craved by museums around the world. In May last year, Picasso's Women of Algiers was sold for a record for a painting at auction of $179 million for one painting. Etta Cohn's collection, which is now in the Baltimore Museum, has 114 drawings by Picasso and 500 works by Matisse. It's the largest and most representative collection of Matisse's works anywhere in the world. And it's conservatively valued at $1 billion. That's $1,000 million. You see, what was once rejected is now priceless and precious. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. And to be a Christian is to see that Jesus is supremely valuable and precious. People may reject and scorn him, but the question is, what do I think? Have I come to him? Because if I have, then I'm part of that building of living stones where God dwells among his people. The great Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple, said, our loyalty as Christians must be first and foremost to Christ himself. And nothing, he said, can take the place of the daily time of intimate companionship with him. We need to come to him personally, one by one. Make time for that, he said, and secure it, and make sure it's real. We must come to him. That's how we come into that building, not through anything else we do. Now, I think it's just worth taking a moment to point out again here, because we saw this last time too, that this response of seeing who he is both our work. We have to make a decision, but it's also God's work. God opens our eyes, and both of those things happen together. We'll never fully understand how it can be both this side of heaven. But again, we find here it is. Look at the second half of verse 8. Those who reject him, Peter says, they stumble because they disobey the message. That's their decision, their choice. But that is also, he says, what they were destined for. And, you know, verse 4, you come to him, you decide to do that. And yet, verse 9, you're a chosen people. Both of those things together. God chooses us and we choose him. Our work and God's work. And as we come to him, we're joined together in this invisible building of living stones. Well, then the question, I guess, is what is our role? What do we do in this building? And so let's go back to where we stopped halfway through verse 5. You're being built together like living stones into a spiritual house, Peter says. What for? Well, to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. A holy priesthood. Now, again, this is going back to the Old Testament, to the temple in Jerusalem, and the only people who could come into the presence of God, into the Holy of Holies, were the priests. An elite group, only Jewish, only male, only from Aaron's priestly line. No one else could do it. And only those people could do two things. They could come into the presence of God, and they could offer acceptable sacrifices. So the really radical thing here is that now anyone who has come to Jesus is a priest, someone who has access to God and who can offer acceptable sacrifices to him through Jesus Christ. This is what is known as the priesthood of all believers. All of us who believe are priests in the sense that we can come to God and offer acceptable sacrifices to him. It's important to know that the word priest is never used in the New Testament of a special group of people. It's always used of every believer. All Christians have this special privilege through Jesus of access to God and ministry for him. That means we're all in ministry. Liz and I don't have any special power or rights with God. We don't have anything at all that you don't have. This bit of plastic just tells you what my job is. It doesn't give me any special rights of access, even though a lot of effort in many parts of the church goes into making you think that priests do have some sort of special power. Don't be fooled, we don't. We're just like you. So we all can come to God and we all have ministry. What are the spiritual sacrifices we offer to God? Well, I think the answer is ourselves, our whole lives. I think it's just worth turning to the beginning of Romans chapter 12, because that's a very well-known verse. Paul has spent 11 chapters telling us what God has done in Christ, and then he says this. It's on page 1139. 11 chapters saying what the gospel is, and then he says this, Romans 12, verse 1. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. The sacrifices you're offering are yourselves, your whole selves, your whole bodies, all that you are. And that is your act of worship, offering yourself to God. Not just something that's done on a Sunday, it is all that you are and all that you have. And this is how the kingdom comes. As people come to Jesus, recognize that he's precious, that he's the king, and offer their lives to him, the kingdom comes, the place where Jesus is king. So let's go back to 1 Peter and look at the last two verses, verse 9. Again, Peter's quoting the Old Testament, and it's from the time when God's people are gathered together at Mount Sinai, and they've just received the Ten Commandments, or they're just about to receive the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 19, and it just echoes, Peter echoes that, and he says, "You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." You are the chosen people. The Jews failed, but now these little funny groups of people scattered around Turkey are the chosen people of God, the ones who've come to Jesus and recognized who he is. You're the royal family, the people belonging to God. Once you are not a people, verse 10, but now you are. Your brothers and sisters together in this new royal family. You appear to have nothing in common. You're just scattered around these different little communities, and yet actually you're the royal family with Jesus as the king. Now think how different that is from any group of religious priests that the world has ever known. They're not from any particular ethnic group. They don't have special jobs or special clothes or special food. You pass them in the street and they just look like anyone else. And yet this is God's chosen priesthood. This is his royal family, his holy nation. If I look at you tonight, you don't look anything special. You're very ordinary. I'm very ordinary. And yet we are the royal family. That's the extraordinary thing about God's plan. In the 10th century, the Russian Tsar, Vladimir I, decided that Russia needed one religion to unite it. So he decided, so the story goes, to go to the two greatest spiritual centers he knew and make a choice between the religions he found there. He went first to Baghdad, and in the great mosque, he saw thousands of Muslims all bowing down in prayer simultaneously. And he thought, wow, this is amazing. Surely Islam is the right choice because it can inspire such obedience. But then he went to the second great center, which was Constantinople. And he went into the magnificent church of Hagia Sophia, which was an extraordinary building for its time, huge building. And he said, "This has shown me a magnificent vision of the transcendent glory of God." So he chose orthodoxy rather than Islam. And of course, 1,000 years later, orthodoxy is still Russia's religion. Well, I guess, I don't quite know, but I guess it was a good thing he chose that rather than Islam. But really, he was looking at completely the wrong thing, wasn't he? You know, no physical building built by human hands could possibly show you the glory of God. He was completely looking in the wrong place. But maybe this temple that God is building of living stones, where Jesus dwells among his people, can show us the glory of God. Our lives as ordinary Christians are designed to shine out the glory of God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness, says Peter. And he picks that up in the bit we'll look at next time in verse 12. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Something about your lives will show the glory of God. Maybe you know that the early Christians in the Roman Empire were called atheists. And the reason was that there was nothing obviously religious about them. You know, imagine a conversation between a Christian and his friend. And the friend says, I hear you've joined this new strange sect of Christians. So where's your temple? Well, we don't have one. We just meet in people's homes. Well, where do your priests live? Well, we don't have any priests. So who offers your sacrifices? Oh, we don't have any sacrifices. So what do you do on your special holy days? Oh, we don't have any holy days. And the Roman friend said, well, that's not religion. And so they were called atheists. Or maybe if the Christian wanted to confuse his friend even more, he could have said, well, we're the temple. We're the priests. We're the sacrifices. And all of our lives are holy and special and set apart for God. And this is where you find God's kingdom. This is where you find God dwelling among his people, not in any particular building, but among God's people. I mean, that is completely different, isn't it, from any human religion. And yet, what a beautiful idea. Because instead of being confined to certain people on a certain day doing certain things in a certain place, this is everybody everywhere. Every Christian who has come to him is God's holy temple. I don't know if you've noticed it, but that's the point of the prayer that we say at the end of the communion service, based, going back to a prayer of Thomas Cranmer. We used it in the communion service last week at the end. We offer you our souls and bodies to be a living sacrifice. Send us out in the power of your Spirit to live and work to your praise and glory. The sacrifice we offer is not the communion service in here, it's ourselves as we go out into the world 7 days a week. Do you see how revolutionary that is? How the completely opposite from human religion. And so when you at work refuse to join in the gossip or the smutty talk, you are being part of God's holy people. You're offering your spiritual sacrifice of yourself to him. You're declaring his praise out in the world by the way you live your life. Not hidden away on a particular day in a religious building, but out into the world. And that is how God's kingdom is built. As Christians who recognize him as king, go out and spread the light into the world. A temple not built by human hands, but built of living stones. Now, of course, that's challenging for us, isn't it? Because it means we're always part of God's holy people. We can't just be holy on a Sunday evening. We can never switch off and say, well, I'm just being myself. We're always God's people. And our purpose is always to live differently and reflect the light of the one who called us. And what makes us different is not funny clothing or religious activities or diets or anything else, but it is ourselves, our very character. In an interview towards the end of the life of the Duke of Windsor, who had been Edward VIII, he recalled his childhood and how when he'd done something wrong, his father, George V, would admonish him and say, "Dear boy, you must always remember who you are." Dear boys and girls, you must always remember who you are as you go out from here. You're the royal family, the priesthood of God, the chosen people, the holy nation. And as we remember who we are, we behave differently. And that is how the kingdom comes. Ordinary people like Peter and me and you living differently, being a people belonging to God. And that is how the eternal building of living stones is built, with Christ at the center. And the good news, Jesus says, is that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So God is still with his people. He is among us. The Lord is here. And our role is to take him out into the world by who we are and the way we live. I think I'll pray. Father, please thank you for calling us. We pray for each one of us here. May we recognize who you are. You're supremely precious. You are the King, the cornerstone. And as we come to you, may we be built into that temple and support one another and have the courage to take your light out into the world. Thank you for calling us, Lord, in all our ordinariness. And please take and use us as living sacrifices for you. Amen.